JC Corcoran Podcast.
And it's time to stretch. Let's welcome Rock and Roll Hall of Fame legend Chuck Berry to guest conduct our 7th inning stretch.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's go, Chicago. A one, a two, a three, a four.
Take
me out to the ball game.
Take
me out to the ground. Buy me some peanuts and check.
I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest is jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over.
Wednesday, the 16th of June, 2021. It's the J.C. Corcoran Podcast here at jconthewine.com. We'll be pushing 100 degrees in St. Louis later on this week. Well, sometimes I don't know if I should be talking about sports on the podcast very much because there's so much sports out there on TV. Every other cable channel is sports. On radio, you got a bunch of AM stations, you got a bunch of FM stations. Everybody's talking sports. And frankly, the men and the women who are doing this on the all sports stations usually know more about this stuff than I do. But in this particular case, I'm going to talk about it because, number one, I've been pitching since I was 8 years old, and I still pitch in the men's senior baseball league. You can tell I'm a pitcher because, 4 years ago, I had to have my rotator cuff replaced and rebuilt. And went out there the following year after the rehab and went 4-0. Okay, so this stuff is still important to me. And I'm a student of pitching. I love the game of baseball. I do cover the game different than most of the other guys that I know who cover sports. These guys are into batting, and I'm not knocking them, by the way. This isn't a criticism. They're into batting averages and OPS. You had him 2-2 in the 7th inning with a man on second base, and you chose to throw a slider. Why'd you do that instead of go with the curve? I mean, that sort of stuff. I'm more interested in what I think the fans are interested in because I consider myself a fan. You have 100 guys on radio TV talking about, you know, some very narrow part of the game of baseball, and I think it's just as interesting to find out that the clubhouse guys clean the players' spikes every night with a big can of scrubbing bubbles. People are always surprised to hear that, by the way. Scrubbing bubbles to clean the spikes? Yes. And I know that you guys love stuff like that, and so that's what I look for. Now, if you happen to be watching the Cubs-Mets game last night on ESPN and all of the coverage on ESPN, and I know, I'm a Cardinal fan. Why am I watching the Cubs? Well, first of all, you want to know what your other teams in your division are doing, right? And because of the big Major League Baseball story yesterday, that's all they were talking about. It was like the game was secondary. The video was of a baseball game, but the audio was like five different guys all talking about the impact that this rule change is going to have on Major League Baseball. And if you're late to the party on this, this is what Adam Wainwright had been talking about in the post-game interview the other night. He's like, well, he said, I got nothing to hide five times in about 45 seconds, and that actually made him look guilty. He just kept saying, I got nothing to hide. I got nothing to hide. I got nothing to hide. It's like, Adam, do you have something to hide? So Major League Baseball pitchers have been trying to figure out ways to doctor the baseball going back all the way to the late 1800s, for heaven's sakes. They used to have a sharp belt buckle, and they would put a little cut in the baseball with the belt buckle and then throw, and the ball would spin better and break better. You had Phil Niekro and lots of other guys throwing spitballs. But Phil Niekro won over 300 games. They put him in the Hall of Fame. So there. But we have technology now because of high definition and super slow-mo cameras and everything like that. They could actually determine the spin rate of the baseball, and the balls are spinning at a rate better and faster and with more break to them than at any point in history as far as we know. And the game is already being hurt by the lack of the ball being in play. I've said this a million times. You want to speed up the game, widen the fucking strike zone already. And then you've really addressed all of these issues, but they apparently are not going to listen to me. They're not going to do that. You know, but you have this, you had the situation with Bob Gibson after his ridiculous 1.12 ERA back in the 60s. They lowered the mound. It used to be 15 inches high. Now it's 10 inches. Then they're talking about either driving the mound again or maybe even moving it back closer to second base because the pitchers have such an unfair advantage. It's hurting the game. There's other ways to address this. I've already mentioned this just a moment ago. They're not going to take any of the suggestions that I have for making the game better. So they got their own ideas. But they are very sensitive to the idea now that apparently, to put it in the words of Mike Schultz, even though baseball pitchers have been doctoring the baseball going all the way back to the beginning of time, it's just gotten out of control now. It's way out of control. You may remember that back in the, I guess it was early 80s, I'm guessing, where in the National Football League, the wide receivers used to be able to put stick'em on their hands and on their gloves, and the quarterback would throw the ball to him, and it was almost like a cat catching a ball of yarn. Or they have those games that you can buy at Target and stuff. They're beach games, a little ball, and they have Velcro on them. So all you have to really do is get the mitt somewhere in the general vicinity of the ball. The ball has the one kind of Velcro. The mitt has the other one. You throw it, and as long as you can get anywhere close to it, that mitt will usually catch that ball. And that's what the receivers looked like in the NFL for a long time. Just stick out their hand, quarterback throw the ball, to stick them would just take care of the rest. The guy would run for a touchdown. So they outlawed that. And it's not that ridiculously out of control in Major League Baseball now, but it's enough of a problem now that they realize they have to deal with it. And they're giving the guys till Monday. And you got a pitcher down in Tampa, and Tampa's a good team. A lot of people think Tampa Rays, the best team in baseball right now. And, you know, he's basically saying that, you know, they made me stop using the stuff I was using to get good grip on the ball, and I had to change my delivery. I hurt my elbow, and now I'm on the injured list. Let's remember that Dizzy Dean still had a lot of years left in his career, but a player by the name of Earl Averill hit a line drive off Dizzy Dean's toe, and he broke it. And Dizzy Dean, being the knucklehead that he was, he tried to come back too soon after the injury. And anything that has anything to do with a pitcher's arm, but especially his feet or his, you know, toes, it's so critical. And Dizzy Dean's out there basically trying to pitch with a sore toe because he tried to come back too early. He had to alter his delivery. He hurt his arm, and his career was over. So you can reduce this pitcher in Tampa, his complaints, to just whining. But the truth of the matter is there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. You can't just say, well, one of the guys on the ESPN game last night said, imagine if you went to the hitters and said, okay, guys, starting Monday, no more pine tar and no more batting gloves. Have at it. First of all, you'd have bats flying all over the place. A guy would swing and, you know, the bat would end up in the dugout. So that as well is a very good point. But I want to take you back to 2006, all right? 2006. Andy Van Slyke, who I've known since 1985, and I would see him socially from time to time. He'd been on the TV with me. He'd been on radio with me. Used to see him around town once in a while. He lived next door to Mike Bush. Yeah, he might still live next door to Mike Bush. I'm not sure. Andy Van Slyke had a batting cage in his basement at this house out in, well, I don't want to say where it is. But anyhow, you may recall that in 2006, it was brutally cold in Detroit. Bitter, bitter cold. I remember you, man, and I were sitting out in right field. They had built an auxiliary press area out there. We were just sitting out in the open. They just basically put some desks in front of the bleacher chairs, and that was it. That was where we watched the game from, and, you know, edited our interviews and stuff like that, and got ready for the post-game stuff, and just watched the game. And a pitcher by the name of Kenny Rogers was pitching for Detroit, and the cameras from behind home plate, and the cameras from behind home plate got an amazing shot of this big brown blob basically on the wrist of Kenny Rogers. It's like he wasn't even attempting to camouflage the fact that he had some sort of sticky substance on his wrist that he was going to be able to get a better grip on the ball in the cold weather. And that situation got a lot of attention. And I got mad at Andy because he went on television and said, people are just complaining because it's like a melted Hershey bar on his wrist. Big deal. It's like, well, first of all, that's dumb. Number two, it was 35 degrees at game time. I don't think any Hershey bar would melt anyhow. And number three, he was lying. And it was very clear to everybody that he was lying and tried to diminish the whole idea that his pitcher, and Andy was a coach for the Detroit Tigers at that time, and, he was defending his player. Okay, fine. But as Judge Judy would say, don't pee on my leg and then tell me it's raining. So, I don't know, it must have been about 6 months later, and I'm over in Frontenac, all right? And we're at that restaurant, Brio, all right? And Andy comes walking in with his lovely bride, Lori. And I see him, and we exchange pleasantries and the whole thing. And then I said, come here, I got to ask you about this. And I basically went back and recounted everything that I just told you here right now. And he told me, and I guess he wouldn't have said this, at least not at that time, in 2006, 2007, somewhere in there. Maybe he wouldn't have said it publicly. Maybe he will say it now. But privately, he told me, he said, look, JC, it's 35 degrees out there, and trust me, the hitters would rather have a pitcher with some sticky stuff that he was going to be able to control the baseball, because nobody wants to get into the batter's box going, geez, it's 35 degrees. I can't feel the tips of my fingers. The pitcher obviously can't feel the tips of his either, and he's about ready to throw a very, very hard sphere in my general direction, and I don't want to get hit in the face with this, so I'd rather have him have a good grip on the ball rather than, the alternative. And when he told me that, I thought it was bullshit, and then I thought about it some more, and like, I wonder if that's true. So I started asking players, hey, look, this is totally off the record, but, you know, this business about doctoring baseballs, is it cool or is it not, particularly in cold weather? And pretty much everybody said exactly what Andy said. And that is that if you choose to look at it that way, there is a safety issue involved. Okay, that was 2006. That's 15 years ago. 15 years ago. And in that time, as I said earlier, two things have happened. The pitchers have gotten better substances that are not only allowing them to get a better grip on the ball, but now to be able to throw pitches that in some cases are unhittable because they get such a tremendous spin rate on it. The batters are standing there going, how would I even hit this? It just broke 3.5 feet. But also the manner in which Major League Baseball is able to detect stuff like this that is going on with pitchers has also greatly improved, and that's why we have the situation that we have. So, if nothing else changes, starting next week, all Major League Baseball pitchers and catchers are going to be really subject to closer examination, and you can read the specifics on the rules yourself, but they're going to be able to go at these guys and say, all right, look, I'm going to inspect you right now, and I need to see your glove. I need to see your hat. All of this, by the way, while Major League Baseball is making such a big deal out of trying to speed up the game, all right? So now, and nobody likes to be groped. And so now you got some guy out there making $30 million a year throwing a baseball, and you're going to have some chubby 65-year-old umpire digging around in his shorts while we all sit around and wait for more game. One step forward, one step back. The first Die Hard movie which is not a Christmas movie, by the way, but that's a discussion for another day. But the first Die Hard movie was such a big success that they made another Die Hard, and then they made a couple after that, too. I don't know how many. It may have been three or four. I don't know. But specifically, Die Hard 2 is where I was on this date in 1990 out in California. And this is one of my favorite stories to tell. If you've heard it, I apologize. Please bear with me for the people who have not heard this story. So you have to understand these junkets, these movie junkets. There are reporters who come in to California or New York. This one was in California, who come in from all these American cities. Portland, Seattle, Dallas, Boston, Tampa, Miami, Chicago, not Green Bay. That's too small. But bring in probably just a little short of 100 of us. Now, these things went on every single weekend in either New York or L.A., and I know people who went on every single one. I mean, they traveled every single weekend of the year with the possible exception of maybe Christmas. And I didn't do that. I picked and chose. I was not going to be one of these people who was I already had something like 500,000 frequent flyer miles on TWA. I didn't really need any more. And some of these movies were such stinkers anyhow. I don't need to see Stop or My Mom Will Shoot 5 to know that the movie sucked even before I walked into the theater. So I went on the ones that I wanted to or the ones I was able to. Obviously, I was working full-time in radio, and so there were certain instances where I was not able to leave town. But in this particular case, on this date in 1990, I'm sitting in my hotel room in California. And the way these things work is they bring these people in from all over the country. They put us in a very, very nice hotel. And then about 6 o'clock, everybody runs downstairs. You hop on a bus and they take you to a movie theater where you see an advanced screening of a movie that's coming out to the general public somewhere in the next few weeks. And like any other group of people, there are some people who are very nice and easygoing and laid back, and then there are people, there are people you wish you could just take a flamethrower to this place. It sounded more like Fred Flintstone than it sounded like Al Pacino, but I'll work on it. Frank Caliendo, I think your job is safe. So go down there, we see the movie, and they always have a little party before the movie, and then they have another party afterwards, and then you get up the next day, and then you run around and you interview Bruce Willis and whoever else was in that movie. And most of the time at the parties before the movie and after the movie, it's just chit-chat and small talk. But in this particular case, sometimes what we would see would be altered by the time it actually made it to the movie theater and you saw the movie. Didn't happen a lot, but it did happen from time to time. And in the case of Die Hard 2, there's a scene in the movie, probably about 15 minutes into the movie, where they're chasing each other through an airport. And in one particular scene, they do one of these super slow motion shots of a bullet approaching a guy's head, and then it pierces his skull and then comes out the other end in beautiful, extra, super slow motion. It was absolutely disgusting. And keep in mind, remember what the Die Hard movies are like. Yeah, they're dramas, but there's a lot of clowning around. There's a lot of jokes in all of the Die Hard movies, And even with that, sort of explanation with that little asterisk right there, there's still not a lot of movies that I could imagine where a scene like that would be appropriate. It was just gratuitous violence, just really, really up close, super slow motion video of a bullet going through a guy's head and coming out the other side. It was disgusting. So we see the movie, we go back to the hotel, and everybody gathers in the lobby where they're having the post-movie party. And there was a guy from Philadelphia by the name of Patrick Stoner. And I don't know where Patrick got this idea, but Patrick thought of himself as an elitist. He just thought that he was the bee's knees, and everybody just sort of put up with it and worked around him, but he was insufferable. And somehow, he and I get into it at the after-movie party about this particular scene, which he defends and which I've already told you my feelings about it. And he and I are really, and our voices are starting to get louder. And of course, the first thing he does is start to impugn my qualifications for even making commentary about movies. That's what an elitist prick he was. And our voices are getting loud. And now there's people gathering around and sort of stepping in between the two of us. And now people on the periphery of the party are looking like, what the hell is going on over there? And I didn't make that much of it. And I went back to my room, and I got up the next day, and I did the interviews, and I got back on the fucking plane, and I came back to St. Louis, and I told everybody, you know, here's my conversation with Bruce Willis, and by the way, there's a scene in this movie that's going to turn your stomach, and pretty much that was it. So I was hanging out with some people at that time, and they're like, hey, we're going to go to the movies. I think it was over the 4th of July, as a matter of fact, and I said, okay, I'll go with you. We're going to go see Die Hard 2. I'm like, oh, no. I end up in the theater with all these people watching Die Hard 2, a movie that I've already seen. And I'm telling people, there's a scene in this movie you're going to really, really hate. Anyhow, long story made short, if that's possible at this time, everybody is looking at the screen. Here comes the big scene. I know it's coming. And no, it isn't. The scene was deleted from the movie. So this was on a Saturday afternoon. The first thing I do on Monday morning is I call the studio in California. I'm like, all right, let's hear it. I went to the movie over the weekend. The scene is gone from the movie. And they're like, well, JC, people from the studio were listening to you and Patrick, and they obviously must have agreed with you because they took the scene out of the movie. I altered the course of motion picture history. That scene was deleted from the movie Die Hard 2 and never, apparently, to be seen again. But there is a small part of me that says, that shouldn't happen. A guy from St. Louis should not be responsible for a scene in a motion picture being deleted. But that's exactly what happened. Just incredible. But that's where I was on this date in 1990. And now this.
And I think it would be a fair statement to say that every comedian here would prefer to be a rock star in real life. Because I think rock stars are the coolest people on the planet. Rock stars are very hip, always flare their nostrils, look like they're about to vomit. They always have that preamble before the song that makes no sense at all. You know, ladies and gentlemen, a long time ago, there were lots of people. That's all I'm trying to say. And a lot of these lyrics, you gotta admit, when you hear songs on the radio, some of these lyrics are very generic, very trite. I mean, to me, it sounds like the guy is making them up as he goes along. You know what I mean? It's like... She's cold as ice. Paradise, and the feeling was a nice. And there's a lady I know. If I didn't know her, she'd be the lady I didn't know. And my lady, she went downtown. She bought some broccoli. She brought it home. She's chopping broccoli, chopping broccoli, she's chopping broccoli, she's chopping broccoli, she's chopping broccoli, she's chopping broccoli, she chop, she chop, she chop, she's chopping broccoli.
I just finished telling you a little while ago that I was had mixed emotions about doing a lot of sports on the podcast, but this is good, though, because this is a good trivia question, a good bar bet, you know? There have been 1,066 different final score combinations in the history of the NFL. Think about that. 1,066 different final score combinations in NFL history. The most recent edition was the Cleveland Browns beating Pittsburgh 48-37 on January 10th. There'd never been a 48-37 final score in the history of the league. The most common final score, 20-17. It happened 269 times in NFL history. I don't really spend any time on eBay, but I know a lot of people who do. One of the very first items ever sold on eBay was in 1995. It was a broken laser pointer, and it sold for $14.83. When the founder of eBay asked why the guy bought it, he said, and this is a quote, "I am a collector of broken laser pointers." Ask a stupid question, get a stupid answer. According to a new report, the most misspelled word last year was quarantine. It was the most Googled how to spell search in 12 different states, and a lot of people thought it was spelled corn-teen. C-O-R-N-T-E-E-N. Corn-teen. Wow. That sure explains a lot about this country, doesn't it? Other words we had trouble with in the last year include coronavirus, favorite, every, believe, definitely, separate, and which. As in, which of those words do you have the most trouble with? We were talking about movies opening up on this date, or at least I was seeing the movie that was going to open up. It was 43 years ago today, 1978, Grease, starring John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John, opened in U.S. theaters. And the Monterey Pop Festival, the first ever major rock festival, happened on this date in 1967, 54 years ago today. Pretty good lineup for 67. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas. The tickets were $350 to $650, and about 50,000 people showed up. And again, back to sports. Moneyball is running on cable right now, and I just watched it the other night, and it really does hold up. It's a damn good movie. Jonah Hill is in the movie, and somebody started this thing on the internet indicating that Jonah Hill just turned 50 years old. Well, he's not 50. He's 37. Somebody actually messed with his Wikipedia page to make him look 52. His actual birth date is December 20th, 1983. I put up a picture of Heidi Klum on my Facebook page yesterday, the Showgram with J.C. Corcoran. You might want to check it out if you're a red-blooded American man. Olympic track and field star Shelby Houlihan has produced for me one of the best stories of the week. She holds the American record for the 1,500 and 5,000 meters. It looks like we're not going to be seeing her in Tokyo this summer, though, because she just got slapped with a four-year ban after testing positive for the anabolic steroid nandrolone. Nandrolone. But she says the only thing she did wrong was eat a tainted pork burrito. In a lengthy Instagram post, Shelby said she'd never even heard of nandrolone, but after Googling it, she learned that certain types of pigs produce high levels of it, and eating pork can produce a false positive. She also said that pig organ meat, also known as offal, O-F-F-A-L, has the highest levels of nandrolone. And what did Shelby just happen to eat 10 hours before her big drug test? A burrito made with pig offal from a Mexican food truck. She says officials rushed to judgment and denied her due process. But with U.S. track and field trials kicking off this weekend, it looks like she's probably out of luck. If you're thinking TV or movies on TV, Loki on Disney Plus debuts today. And The Handmaid's Tale, season number 4, premieres on Hulu today. And Margaret is going to be on with Seth Meyers tonight. She does not do much TV, but I think she's in some new movie or something. I can only tell you that if you would been around in the 60s, or if you were around in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, there was nothing like Ann Margaret. Nothing like Ann Margaret. I have a hard time believing this is true, but until we can find out that it's some sort of a hoax, I'll do the story. A bride's wedding registry is going viral because it demands, mind you, guests spend at least $400, no exceptions. And she's specifically asking for a new car, floor tiles for the whole house, and Gucci purses. Also, any high-class paintings or decorations. We don't know who this woman is, and they have taken down the post, but there was a screenshot that somebody got of it first. Let's find out down the line whether this was intended to be satire. The adult toy site Adam and Eve did a new survey on America's porn-watching habits, and only 57% of people admitted they ever watch porn. So you're saying 43% of adults never do. 68% of men said yes, 48% of women. It's not clear who they included in the poll, whether it was the general public or just people who visit their website. But if it was just Adam and Eve customers, you'd think it would be closer to 100%, wouldn't you? The summer of 1969 was the best summer of my life. There's a lot of people who reference the best years of their lives, and they talk about it in high school yearbooks and stuff. But when were the actual best years of your life? A new poll asked people which decade represented or will represent their best years. And the biggest group, 24%, said their 30s. 21% said their 20s. 15% said their 40s. 9% said their 50s. And it sort of diminishes from there. Interestingly, when you break it down by age, the majority of people seem to choose their current age as their best years, which is cool. Even among those 55 and older, 35% said the best years would be in their 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s. And Missouri didn't make it on the list of one of the best places to live, but it did make it on the list of one of the most affordable states to live in, along with Alabama, West Virginia, Arkansas, Indiana. California, by the way, is the least affordable. And a lot of people are dealing with sunburns right now. We know that because Google Trends put out a report that searches for sunburn remedies, and they're way up. Here are the top five sunburn fixes people are Googling right now. Does shaving cream help a sunburn? Well, the answer is sort of yes and no. It won't magically get rid of it, but they usually have menthol, which has cooling effects and helps with inflammation. Does aloe help? You're darn tootin'. Yes, aloe vera is the most popular thing people use. It helps with the pain, the redness, the inflammation. It also makes your skin produce more collagen, so it heals faster. How about vinegar? Maybe, but could also make things worse. Some people swear apple cider vinegar works for sunburns, but vinegar is acidic, so you have to dilute it a lot, and if you don't, it can burn you even more. How about lotion? Does that help with a sunburn? Yes, but it should be non-oil based. Anything with oil can trap the heat and make it hurt even more if you put it on too soon. So in general, wait a day with oil-based stuff, but moisturizing while you recover is always a good idea. And what about coconut oil? Again, yes, but don't put it on right away because the oil can trap the heat. And speaking of lotions and remedies and stuff like that, the FDA wants Johnson & Johnson to discard 60 million vaccine doses. Where in the world would you stick 60 million needles other than in Courtney Love's forearm? And it was 6 years ago today in 2015, the guy by the name of, what's his name here? Oh, yeah, that's right. Donald Trump officially announced that he was actually serious about running for president.
Nobody can do it like me. Nobody.
Nobody does it better.
Nobody can do it like me. Honestly.
Though sometimes I wish someone could.
Nobody's stronger than me.
Nobody has better toys than I do.
Nobody does it quite the way you do.
Nobody builds walls better than me.
Why'd you have to be so good?
There's nobody bigger or better at the military than I am.
Nobody loves the Bible more than I do.
Whenever you hold me,
nobody's better.
There's some kind of magic inside you.
And nobody even understands it but me.
That keeps me from running.
Nobody's better.
But just keep it coming.
I know what it means.
How'd you learn to do the things you do?
Nobody's fighting for the veterans like I'm fighting for the veterans.
Yeah.
nobody that's done so much for equality as I have.
Makes me feel safe for the rest.
There's nobody more conservative than me.
Nobody does it half as good as you.
Nobody would be tougher.
Baby, baby.
Nobody knows more about trade than me.
There is nobody that respects women more than I do.
Nobody's ever had crowds like Trump has had.
There's nobody that understands the horror of nuclear better than me.
Nobody knows the game better than I do.
Nobody in the history of this country has ever known so much about infrastructure as Donald Trump.
I know the H-1B, I know the H-2B. Nobody knows it better than me.
Nobody knows politicians better than I do.
Nobody knows more about taxes than I do.
Nobody knows more about debt than I do.
Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it.
And he did, too. All right, that's it. The J.C. Corcoran podcast is in the can for the 16th of June, 2021. We post every weekday morning at 7 o'clock. Continue to spread the word. Tell your friends that we are here every morning at jcontheline.com. Enjoy the rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning. In the meantime, we beat this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
The J.C. Corcoran podcast. We'll be right back.